Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. My name is Michael Walker. I'm here with my co-host, Mark. How are you today, Mark?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Very good.
We're back.
We're back. We skipped a week due to some weather, but we're here and we're going to talk about the game we reviewed exactly 1 year ago, then the games we played this week and last week. And that should pretty well round us up for more than an hour. So no topic and no main game, just a whole bunch of games we played over the last 2 weeks.
And some news, and why it doesn't matter.
It's true.
So, Walker, what did we review last year?
Exactly 1 year ago, we reviewed a game by a fairly unknown designer. It's raw, pretty well considered one of the worst bidding games out there.
Your sarcasm is just so straightforward. So this was an honor,
It was episode 270. I found it odd that it took us 270 episodes to review Raw. What happened there?
It is because we timed it with the 25th Century Games new version.
Gotcha.
And because listeners were interested to hear us talk about it in a sustained way. I mean, so there we were.
And not that we didn't play it a ton. Like I said, Raw is one of the greatest bidding games that are out there. There are situations that may arise where, say, it's a 5-6 player game, and then everyone passes out, and then it's only one or two players, you know, pulling from the bag. Everyone's chanting chicken. Lots of excitement.
Because that's the thing that truly elevates it. I mean, Reiner Knizia has done a number of truly excellent auction games. The thing that makes me prefer Raw over something like Modern Art has a purity to it, and it's about market evaluation and risk. Raw is also about risk, less about market evaluation, and it's that push-your-luck element. I've experienced no game that does push-your-luck half so well as Raw does, because you're in a situation where you figure, all right, I've got the currency, I can win this lot. And then suddenly you just push your luck, you try to make the lot better than it was, and suddenly it's become a poison pill because something came up that is so terrible that you now have to reevaluate all your economic decisions. And every tile pull can completely cause the value of the lot to change for everybody. It's marvelous. And it really is one of those games where sometimes you play those games where it's not even a complexity level. It's just about the nature in which you're interacting with other players, and you just didn't observe that giving them that one building or giving them that one tile was of supreme importance to them. In Raw, that doesn't tend to happen. Everything is so transparently obvious. The dynamics of how the market shifts are so accessible, and that just makes the decision-making so much more intense and satisfying. Raw is absolutely one of the all-time greats. And we've played it several times since reviewing it, and it's absolutely going to remain in rotation for... I could never imagine a context in which I would remove Raw from rotation.
That's true.
That is Raw by Reiner Knizia, originally published by Alia in 1999, but has been reprinted many a time, and if you can find it, my recommended edition is the Uberplay edition. Although, to be frank, I'd be very curious to try the Dice Tree edition, although it appears rather, to use a word from the pre-show show, to use a word from Furnace Time, looks a little garish.
Just a little.
So, now onto the games we played last week. Walker, what did you play last week?
Mark, listeners want us to try Mistborn, the deck-building game. It wants us to know it's a deck-building game, so they put it in the title.
Well, this is to differentiate it from a number of other Mistborn games.
True,
because Mistborn is a fantasy universe by Brandon Sanderson.
Yes. Right from the Wikipedia, it says it's a series of epic fantasy novels.
Yes.
by American author Brandon Sanderson.
Do you have any experience with Brandon Sanderson?
I do not.
Yeah, neither do I.
Mistborn, the deck-building game, on the other hand, is designed by John D. Clare, put out by Brotherwise Games, and it does a few twists on the standard deck-building system. You have this sort of palette of different elements of metals, and you're going to be using them to cast different cards out and buy cards.
The characters are allomancers, which means they do magic with metal. Apparently, they...
I thought they were doing magic with owls. That's why they're called allomancers.
Allomancers.
Oh,
wow.
So this is all making more sense now.
Common mistake. All right. Apparently, they swallow the metal, and that gives them some ability, and that's called burning. What do they think? They're cosmic frogs, and they've got a star in their stomach? I don't understand, but I'm sure in context it makes sense. Brandon Sanderson has his fans, but the upshot is that you have, as Walker says, a variety of metals, and you have some ability to just generate some metals every turn that goes up as the game progresses, and or you can discard cards of the appropriate type to power other cards of the same type.
Or superpower
existing cards of the same type.
Cards that you've already cast as well. I'm sure we're going to be playing it a lot more because we sort of enjoyed our play of it. So I'm sure I'd like to, you know, figure out different strategies and stuff like that.
It's an interesting space because it's very similar to Shards of Infinity or the Realms games. A lot of it is about generating combat, and you advance along a training track, which determines how many medals you can use. That is not entirely unlike the mastery system in Shards of Infinity. It also has a solo/co-op mode, not entirely unlike Shards of Infinity, but it is significantly more complex than Shards of Infinity. There's a lot more things that you can do with the cards. There's been a fair degree of creativity in terms of the effects. The universe of effects is significantly larger, but not nearly as large as, say, a Game of Dominion. And you have a variety of trade-offs. Like, you have to figure out, especially early on, which cards you're going to play and which cards you're just going to forsake. And so you're torn in a number of different directions. And that, in turn, influences your purchasing decisions. It is also longer than Shards of Infinity. This is to be expected. It is not an uncomfortable length, but you have to understand what you're getting into. This is definitely, you know, closer to the length of something like Dominion. It is not nearly as long as the more sustained deck builders, like any of the longer co-op ones, or even not even approaching something like Imperium. But it is much more of approaching the middleweight as far as a lot of the other lighter things. And it's been a while, frankly, since I played a new deck building game that was in this sort of sphere. Most of them have been super light or indeed experimenting on the heavier ends.
There were some fiddly bits. Like, there's sort of like, I don't know, it's a turn track or sort of boost yourself up every turn. Before your turn begins, you have to make sure you move up the track. Next person goes, they move up the track. Next person, move up the track.
It's shockingly easy to forget, yeah.
And then you have all, like I say, a plethora of different elements that all have tokens that you're moving on and off your board. You know, it's a minor thing, but it just seems a little bit fiddly for the weight of the game itself.
Well, it's definitely a lot fiddlier than most deck building games, certainly of its weight. Again, because most deck builders tend to be very, very simple, and the overall approach to deck building, certainly post-Dominion, has been play all the cards in your hand. So the moment you're no longer playing all of them, and you're only playing some of them, that also adds a certain level of, you might want to call it fiddliness. I wouldn't necessarily classify it in those terms, but I understand where you're coming from. And like I say, it's just been a while since I played a deck builder of Mistborn's weight, of the overall approach that does of kind of synthesizing the combat scoring purity of something like Shards of Infinity with a little bit more Baroque effects. And I enjoyed it. I have a certain number of questions about the universe. Like, taking these details of the universe out of context, again, no shade on Brandon Sanderson. I'm sure the novels are very good. He's a very, very popular and acclaimed author. But the co-op version, for example, has you fighting the despot who is in charge of the city. And his name is, and I quote, Lord Ruler. I have to assume he is some kind of measurement fanatic. He's got a variety of accomplices like Lieutenant Protractor and perhaps the Grand Marquess of Measuring Tape.
Well, he's trying to keep their imperialists, you see, Mark. So they're trying to keep the imperial system in, and the evil metrics are attacking. You see this? Maybe I did read the
Something
books.
Something all makes sense?
This is all coming back to me now. I think I did. I must have read the books. That is Mistborn, the deck-building game.
And I saw no mist.
Yeah, there was
no mist. Lots of metal, no mist.
No mist.
Got Cerebria the Inside World to the table after many months of attempts. Now, the problem with Cerebria the Inside World is that if you're playing with new players, you want to play with four. You can play with fewer or you can play with more, but at that point, you're typically bringing in the expansion. And I would prefer not to do that with new players, and so to keep things as simple as possible and to exploit the team play element, two teams of two is the way to go, especially for first play. And this is not a number that we frequently encounter, but I had the opportunity, and after a number of attempts, this is one of those things where you really have to exert a certain degree of effort, because no one's going to stumble across a Mind Clash game and just pull it out at random. And the rules explanation is definitely burdensome, and the terminology is exacting, and you have to refer things by the appropriate terms, or you're apt to get confused. All of that having been said, Cerebria the Inside World is a fabulous game and well worth the effort. And I found it very gratifying that everyone else at the table truly appreciated it and really enjoyed what was going on and found the team play very, very satisfying. And so it's not just a two-player game that's been stretched out into a four-player game. It is absolutely a four-player game. I will also say, I commented about this in the context of Race for the Galaxy, and Charlie Teal is going to be talking about this too, and I'm very interested to hear his thoughts. I found the complexity of the rules explanation of Race for the Galaxy to kind of be much lower than my recollection of it from, say, 10 years ago. And I did indeed find the rules explanation for Cerebria, you know, burdensome. It's about an hour rules explanation for about a 75-minute game, which is wild, not entirely unlike some of the PAX games. But this table of, you know, medium to medium-heavy Eurogamers, they took to it immediately. There were hardly any questions. Everyone remember how everything worked. The dynamics of how the different interlocking elements work were quickly internalized. And so I do think that the increasing complexity of your contemporary hobbyist game is at least paying some dividends in terms of comprehension. So I do appreciate that. So Cerebria is about manipulating the emotions or internal development of a human individual. It is like, what's the Pixar movie, Inside Out?
Yep.
Okay. That's the theme of the game. That helps get it to the table as well. And it's an area majority contest where you're playing out these emotions, you're intensifying these emotions, you're enhancing these emotions, you're upgrading your actions, you're these various manifestations of what we might call human nature, like hatred or delight. The groove is on Heartwalker.
And the art is fantastic. It's not just, and because there are models too, and just like the flow of the models, they're just not like these two dimensionals, oh, here's hate, it looks evil. It's like, I think, these wispy things. And
absolutely.
It gives you this feel of what you're doing and just adds to the game, right? It puts you in the game.
And the deluxe version comes with lovely pre-painted miniatures. And what I really like is the quality of the card play, the fact that it's combo-tastic without the turns spiraling out of control, because you have three actions and a small amount of currency, and you really need to figure out how to advance the victory conditions, which are constantly in flux. There's this set of victory conditions that is repeated three times over the course of the game. There are the public objectives, and then each side has their own deck of private objectives, which mirror the public objectives, but will not be the same at the same time. So I might be trying for A and C at any given time, and the other team is trying for A and G at the same time, and we're competing over one element, but the other elements we don't know, and it's very, very tight, very difficult, but very satisfying to figure out how, with the resources available to you, to get that action done. And I am a huge fan of Cerebria the Inside World. I'm glad that it is getting a little bit more credibility ever so slowly here amongst locals, and I will play it at any given opportunity. I would really like to get the expansion back to the table, because the expansion introduces the third faction, which really makes the player count more flexible. At that point, you can play with three players, and it's not at its best, but you can actually do it. And the third faction more or less wants to orchestrate ties, as one might imagine. And Cerebria is extraordinarily well done. It was back before Mind Clash had stumbled with dinosaurs. It's tough. People stumble with dinosaurs. It happens. Yeah. I see it in movies. Cerebria the Inside World was designed by Richard Amon, Victor Peter, István Pakcsi, Frigyes Schoberl, Nick Shaw, and David Tsurtse, published by Mind Clash Games in 2018. It was their second design after Anachrony. And for what it's worth, it and Voidfall, I think, are their best work.
So Mark was nice enough to bring a game to the table called 1793 Patriots and Traitors. This is designed by Jason St. Just and published by Sound of Drums. I'm going to compare it to Twilight Struggle because it's not just one of these, you know, one thing in the game like I usually do. It is very similar. There is a large deck of cards that represents a bunch of different things that happened in history or for the particular, you know, theme of the game. There's all these different happenings and leaders and rulers and government officials and things mixed up, and they're going to come in random order than they did in actual history. But it really helps if you know what's in that deck. If you know what's coming up, you're going to have somewhat of an advantage. Every player has their own sort of small mini way they can win. Very difficult to do, but you can do it. But then there's this overall...
Not every player.
Some players have this. Then there is the overall way everyone can win, which is like this sort of area majority map, and you're trying to, you know, make sure things don't happen there. It is very much a policing game. You have to see what the other players are doing, stop other players from doing things. I feel as though that there is a game there, but it is one of those games that the same group of people need to play it multiple times, I think, to get the most out of it. I don't think it's going to really shine at a sort of one-off and then it brings more players in and try it again. I really think it's a play a few times with the same people, then it will start to shine.
I understand your comparison to Twilight Struggle, but I disagree in the following ways. Twilight Struggle stacks its historical events into three different decks and highlights the scoring opportunities in each deck. And so in teaching a new player who is utterly unfamiliar with the overall historical dynamics of the Cold War, you can nonetheless tell somebody, okay, in the early deck, these regions will score. And so these are the regions that are more likely to be more important in the first couple of turns of the game. Okay, and we've now proceeded to the middle game. We can now care about this. If you then know a little bit more about 20th century history, you might know, as the Americans, that if you dump a whole bunch of influence into Cuba before the Castro event comes out, well, then you're probably going to have a bad time. And the same is true of Egypt. The same is true of a variety of other places. I am a big fan of the theme of 1793. This is about the French Revolution. This is about the governing structures that arose after the early revolution. This, in point of fact, starts in 1793 after the Feuillants have mostly been sidelined in terms of majority influence. And what originally appealed to me, I'll try to keep this to under about 5 hours, was that this, in some ways, is covering the same period of history as La Révolution Française, La Patrie en Danger. But unlike being a six-player, a six-hour game, 1793 is a five-player, you know, 90 to 120 to maybe three-hour game. And that is absolutely more approachable and with a much, much smaller rule set. And I was hoping to get some degree of the same level of satisfaction. What we have in this deck of cards, as you say, because it's very much a card-driven game, is a whole bunch of different events and a whole bunch of different leaders that might or might not get played for some kind of ops versus event tension. And that indeed is very similar to Twilight Struggle and other card-driven war games. The leaders and the events are all over the place. So very early on in our game, Dewey had two leaders up on the table that let him basically do a variety of things for free. And so he was advancing his victory conditions trivially, just by virtue of his established leader presentation. One of the leaders was particularly egregious because not only did it boost all his other actions, it prevented us from being able to boost our actions in the conventional way anyway. It basically shut off an area of the board, saying nobody gets to do that anymore, but you, Dewey, get to pretend as though you're winning it all the time. It's like, okay, fine. So I can kind of imagine what the defenders and supporters of 1793 would say. Oh, well, it's the job of the table to police them. And to a certain extent, that's what happened. Huey played an assassin card and had one of the leaders killed. But what is actually going on here? Well, Dewey had a couple of turns of his banked advantage, and Huey had to spend one of his few turns in 1793 doing the rest of the table of Benny. So, who is the one who is worst off in this scenario? That would be Huey. Huey is now way behind everybody else. Everybody who's not Dewey has been taking it on the chin for a few rounds, and Dewey's incredible scoring capacity has now been somewhat pared down to the rest of us, but he still gets the inherited benefit of all those rounds where he was just spewing cubes out the entire time. This is setting aside the fact that the early turns take on a 1v-all dynamic, where the royalists seem to have a tremendous military advantage if the rest of the table doesn't completely cooperate against them, which then leads to all the standard problems of a 1v-all setup. And this is on top of the fact that the rulebook is, shall we say, less than clear. This is me being euphemistic. This is me being overly charitable. Now, not only does it use the male pronoun as neuter, which I think is unacceptable in 2024, it has a variety of strange elements of, I would say, mistranslation, but the designer claims that he uses idiomatic English. The terms that he employs are not consistent with my understanding of any native language speaker. But anyway, using must not for may, that's not how words get used. And consequently, there are a large number of rules questions that I'd had after reading the rules manual. And I just had to decide to apply things a certain way. Ultimately, it was a confusing at times and overall dispiriting experience. I really wanted it to capture some of the political dynamics of La Révolution Française, or indeed of any of the sort of multiplayer historical games that I really like. And instead, it was a series of people looking at cards being like, okay, well, this is garbage, and not really understanding how to get where we needed to go. And it just was not what I was looking for at all. I came away very disappointed with 1793 Patriots and Traitors. And ultimately, I am inclined to go back to La Révolution Française, La Patrie en Danger, because even though it is an overlong, over-chromed monstrosity, you do at least get some of those interesting interpersonal dynamics while wrestling with the rules, as opposed to 1793, where I just felt that the cards were just spewing a whole bunch of weird, arbitrary events at us.
So let's segue into not getting to where we needed to go. We played a game called Navigador, which is Latin for navigator. This is a Matt Gertz game. This is published by P.D. Verlag, and it's a typical Matt Gertz rondel game. And what's supposed to happen is everyone is supposed to advance through the game, pushing forward, and eventually getting to Nagasaki, where the game will end.
Well, not necessarily.
Well, I mean, that is how the game ends.
That's one of the two end game conditions. True. And how many people are pushing for that is a function of players' decisions.
True. But we had one player who ended up going very hard at colonizing things. So the other players invested less into boats. And at the same time, we had another player invest heavily in docks or shipyards, which made it harder for the people to get boats. So the incentive to get boats was almost negated by these two reasons. So there wasn't this normal push forward in the boat area, which I think led the game to last longer than it normally would.
Yes, it was somewhat longer than most games are. Navigador is usually 75 to 90 minutes. This was about 90 minutes, all told. It was a little bit on the longer end. But again, this was an organic product of the various choices that people had made. And it wasn't just one player who colonized heavily. Both Huey and Dewey had a long stack of colonies and a considerable economic output as a consequence. And mostly the factor that led to the monopolization of shipyards was because multiple people went heavy into churches, which is the other high victory point expensive building.
Overall, I thought it was great. It had this very interesting sort of stock manipulation where you sold goods and processed goods and moved the market up and down. And you could see how, you know, once people got into different sections of the map, it would spike the different commodities and you'd have to quickly try to get the factories in place so you could start utilizing these goods. I think I would like to get back to Navigador again and see how it would play differently if the sort of flow worked sort of the way I think it would. I don't want to say supposed to go, but I think it might evolve differently with a different play.
Okay, well, frankly, I think part of the blame can be vested on me because I was the one who had the shipyards and I just never built ships. I would have been able to end the game considerably sooner at no penalty to my score if I had just built ships a little bit earlier. But I was very inefficient around the rondel, and so consequently never really felt like I had time to go and build ships, because I really think that the efficiency puzzle of the rondel is really well done in Navigador. It is always a hallmark of Matt Gertz rondel games that the efficiency puzzle is tricky. You're always pulled to stop on every available space, but you really can't play that way because that's just being very, very inefficient and wasting your time. On top of that, one of the things that keeps Navigador in my consciousness, and one of the reasons why I keep mentioning it in the context of this podcast, is because it does supply and demand really well. You're exactly right. You have to money is very tight in Navigador, and to figure out how to make very efficient market actions which get you a lot of money, which allow you to do all those other things that you want to do, you have to look at where the market is going, you have to look at what your opponents are doing, and make economic choices to capitalize off of that. If a player to your right or two seats to your right, depending, has a whole bunch of sugar factories, well then, that means that sugar plantations are going to be very remunerative to you, and you want to seize on those opportunities because they're going to be pushing the price up, and vice versa, for all of the different goods. And the way the prices fluctuate, I think, is supremely well done, with very, very little fiddly overhead, and a great deal of player interaction, because on top of all this, you have all the standard Euro elements of, well, I bought the cheaper shipyard, so the next shipyard's more expensive for you, and I took the privilege you want, so you can't take the privilege anymore, and the race for the colonies and all that. So it's got all that first two element. But on top of that, you've got this really, really well done supply and demand mechanism. And that's one of the reasons why I keep going back to Navigator, despite the fact that thematically and visually it is very much of Euro games of 20 years ago, in that it is unapologetically colonialist and very brown. The brown doesn't bother me so much anymore. The fact that it is just a straightforward, like, It's not explicitly yay colonialism like Imperial Struggle was a couple years ago from GMT, but it's very much just, hey, the Portuguese went and made all these colonies. Go do that.
Yeah, and then you're gonna be littering this map with all of these colony tiles, and it's like, nah, we don't need to put interesting art on any of those. We'll just put a little hut there and a tree. That's fine. We're good. Yeah. Yeah. So it is pretty rough looking by today's standards, but still very tight. Very interesting. We sort of praised the market system. It is a little fiddly. A lot of the players had, including me, I needed one extra. Some players needed four extra rules going over of the market system.
Well, that doesn't necessarily make it fiddly. Like, maintaining it is very, very easy.
Just much different than anything else that's out there.
I think part of the problem is that it's so simple that I think people are overcomplicating it.
That's also true. As soon as I got it in my head, it's like, oh, you just, every commodity triggers once, and either you're selling it or you're producing it.
Yep.
And then it was like, oh, all right.
Absolutely.
I think maybe you're right. It just seemed more complicated than it was.
In the interest of full disclosure, I assisted with the translation of Navigator into English. I did a couple passes of the rulebook for Matt Gertz, but Navigator remains one of my favorite Matt Gertz designs and one of my favorite Euros of its type. And there are a very, very small number of Euros of this, you know, very colonial, very brown era that still, I think, are worth bringing to the table, and Navigator is absolutely one of them. Played another game of Galactic Renaissance. This was my first opportunity to introduce Galactic Renaissance to a diehard Inish fan, because I am of the opinion, as we've commented a number of times before, that Galactic Renaissance manages to capture a lot of what made Inish intriguing, but without having a lot of the elements that cause Inish to spiral out of control, like the one-shots, like the way conflicts work. And so I was very keen to see the response. I'm very loath, in general rule, to compare games to other games that people have played, because that can create false expectations. I'll never forget the time when I pitched someone Through the Desert by saying, oh, it's got some elements of Go, and they were a very, very big Go player. And they hated Through the Desert. And they're like, oh, well, what's the problem? It's like, it's nothing like Go at all. I'm like, it's like Go in the following three ways. What's the problem? But no pieces get removed. It's like, oh, okay. Yeah, that is a way that it's not like Go. Sure. But that's fine. Like, you make these associations, and it can be very difficult to shake those over the course of the game. So I always be like, yeah, it's by the same guy who did Inish. I think some of the ways it's kind of like Inish, but not really. That's as far as I was willing to go. But it went really, really well. And again, one of my misgivings about Galactic Renaissance is that you don't tend to see many conflicts, at least the way we play, because they're very, very costly, and everyone has to pay. There was a lot more conflict in this particular game, which is to say we had about three or four. It wasn't a huge amount of conflict, but vastly more than the typically one or sometimes zero that we have in other contexts. And I think the game was more dynamic as a consequence. It made different specialists, which is to say the special asymmetric cards that you get, more valuable. It led to a greater sense of risk. It led to a greater unwillingness to spread yourself too thin. And so you really felt pulled in a variety of different directions. And at the same time, you got to experience all the great Galactic Renaissance asymmetry and deck cycling, because you never shuffle your deck and you only score when your senator comes up. I really like Galactic Renaissance. I've been getting back to it fairly regularly ever since we reviewed it, and I think it really holds up well. I will even play it at 5 with the 5-player expansion. It's an extraordinarily well-done game. Christian Martinez has promised that he has a political trilogy, and this is the second game, so I'm absolutely very curious about what he's got next, because even Inish, which I don't really enjoy playing, as I said, had some elements that intrigued me and made me fascinated with the design, although not necessarily keen to play it. And so Christian Martinez, I think, absolutely is a designer to watch. It's Further Experiences with Galactic Renaissance, designed by Christian Martinez, published by Matago last year, pursuant to successful crowdfunding.
Speaking of crowdfunding, my copy of Cyclades Legendary Edition finally showed up. Cyclades was produced a long time ago. This was a 2-year in the making reimagining of what Cyclades is. It was sort of loosely based in Greek mythology, troops on a map type game. The original and this one has this interesting sort of bidding system where you're bidding on the gods. They all have different actions that you're going to do during the game. This will also determine turn order of the game. And in both versions, I feel it's fairly tight, tighter in the original. Also has all these mythological beasts that will come out and boats and things that happen. Now, there was a problem with the first one. They had, you know, they had multiple expansions. They brought out these a Titan expansion with the had heroes that loosened up movement a bit.
Which the Titans,
which I think it needed a little bit because there's only one god that lets you move around.
Well, there's only one god in the base game that lets you move troops.
Yes.
Which is to say Ares. You can move boats with Poseidon. And indeed, most of the time, because it's Cyclades, it's a series of islands, seldom is it the case that you'll be progressing across land borders. Most of the time, you're going to need to convoy over ships. And so in order to engage in conquest, what you needed to do frequently was to get your ducks in a row. Although ducks don't tend to be very good, I recommend triremes. You can use ducks in a pinch, but generally, or Canada geese, if you can tame them. But then again, you'll probably win with tamed Canada geese anyway.
Hands down.
Yeah, absolutely. But you'll need to have had your boats in the right place and then get Ares, and only then can you launch an invasion. And this may sound like it was very, shall we say, tricky, but it led to a sort of very staged approach to the auctions, knowing that, well, if nobody wins Ares, then no one will be able to do this invasion. If nobody wins Poseidon, no one can do this other invasion or set up for this other invasion. And so it really changed the parameters of the values of the various gods that you were bidding on.
With Titans and this new edition, we now have heroes, and every god except sort of the booby prize Apollo at the end.
Why are they going to do Apollo so dirty?
I don't know. Someone had to, Mark. Someone had to take the hit. And much like in Cyclades, when you take the hit to take Apollo, Apollo had to take the hit.
Why am I going
to
do Apollo so dirty?
So now every god gives you the option. It makes it more expensive because money is tight in Cyclades. And you need this money.
Much less tight now.
Much less tight. Yeah. But you need this money to bid on these different areas. So moving with your hero is expensive as well. One coin for the first, and then it gets exceedingly more expensive as you try to go further along. So you can do these long-lasting invasions with your hero. It will reduce the number of troops. Combat is very simple and does not slow the game down as much as it does in other games. But the more attacking you do with your hero, the less troops he has to support him. That will put them in risk of being destroyed. The other thing they did with heroes that is new in this new edition is that they all have a discard ability, which will make you not have a hero anymore. And much like, you know, making it very difficult to move your ships, there is only one god that will let you buy a hero. So the fact that you have a hero, one hero in the whole game, is pretty big on its own. Multiple heroes. So discarding that hero is a big hit, but it will let you push you towards that victory condition, which is putting out three of these big metropolises, which is very difficult to do. So it has, you know, have out all your troops is one of the things. Discard that hero, put out a metropolis. Have all your boats out. Have, you know, seven different land areas. All these different, you know, sort of thresholds. If you reach, you can discard your hero and you get a free metropolis.
So there are new ways to get metropolises, and there are consequently new victory conditions. Originally, it was two metropolises and you're done. Now it's three. So this is a considerable increase in terms of the scope of what's going on in Cyclades. The rules grid doesn't expand considerably, but the number of different variables that can lead you to these victory conditions increase. Previously, it was more or less only the case that you could get a Metropolis through getting four Philosophers, because everyone knows Philosophers are the very best special power, or by getting one of each kind of building. Now, on top of that, you have these hero conditions, and the heroes give you more opportunities to move, and there are more things you get to do on your turn regardless. And so, consequently, the scope just keeps expanding and expanding, and I don't think that that's to Cyclades' benefit, because the original game was a very tight auction system where money was excruciatingly scarce, turn order mattered a whole heck of a lot, and you really needed to be careful about how to set up your military expansion and indeed just the disposition of your troops. When you start, and this was kind of my misgiving with the Titans expansion as well, a lot of people swore by the base game of Cyclades once you get the Titans expansion in there. I wasn't a massive fan of it, frankly, because I think it made movement less special, more easy to be had. And in the new version as well, you know, one movement for one coin. Money, first of all, is more plentiful in the new edition because it is very easy to get priestesses. And priestesses just give you a discount on every bid you make. And so effectively, it's like extra income. I was actually surprised a couple rounds in how much money I had to throw around. Granted, everyone has a lot more money to throw around, but at that point, if you have a hero, spending one coin to move them is borderline trivial, whereas in the original game, it might not have been. And ultimately, therefore, it just feels a lot more loose. A lot more is going on, but you lose a lot of that tension. The bidding wasn't as satisfying to me because of the extra amount of money. And to sum all this up, to sort of conclude all of these details, the base game often ended in a very, very unsatisfying way because there's this random deck of monsters. In particular, one of them is infamous, and anybody who's played, I think, Cyclades multiple times knows what I'm talking about. This is the Pegasus. The Pegasus says, teleport a unit of troops from anywhere to anywhere. The odds of there being an undefended building that could get you a Metropolis or a flat Metropolis by itself, usually pretty high. It was so bad that there was also, you had to pay attention to the monster that says fish a monster from the discard pile, and you cared a great deal whether that came up before or after Pegasus did. I haven't played Cyclades a huge number of times, but I'd say a very high proportion of them get ended on the Pegasus. And we played the new expanded Legendary Edition. I was somewhat surprised that Pegasus is still there. And sure enough, Pegasus was used to snag a Metropolis at a crucial time. So, I don't know, man.
So, well, I'm saying in the game I just played the other day, it was literally, I had three Metropolises. I was going to win. There was one player left to go. They paid $1 to look at the top card.
Zeus says you get to play the top monster off the deck for $1 if you want.
Guess what was on the top, Mark?
I'm going to guess Pegasus Walker.
Pegasus. So, yeah, so they get three, and because they only had to pay $1 to get it, they had more money than I did. So I'm not complaining that I lost. I'm complaining, it might sound that I am. And, you know, there's 2% sprinkled in there about me being,
two?
Being
okay.
Salty.
Okay. Well, plus
but the rest
two.
Of it is after a two-hour game,
yeah.
For it to end like that is kind of disappointing.
I agree. It is not a very satisfying end. I don't really remember Cyclades ever ending in a way that I regard as satisfying. It doesn't really play to its strengths. The auction is great. The auction is tense and tight. And if you introduce more money and more things that don't care about what god you won, like the heroes, I think you are undermining the central conceit of Cyclades. When Pegasus is out of the game, and I've known a number of people who like Cyclades but just retire Pegasus and make it go away. Look, none of the monsters are what I would regard as particularly deterministic or particularly strategic in nature, but few of them have the effect on the game that Pegasus does, if not none of them. And it just encourages or increases the proportion of times that the game will end in an unsatisfying way. I don't know if it fundamentally does violence to the balance of Cyclades, either the base version or the new legendary version, to retire Pegasus entirely, but that would certainly be my preference, all things being equal.
I have to say that this new edition looks fantastic, has these very miniatures, look great. Everyone has their own little storage case with boats and troops. Looks great, sets up nice, it teaches much. I don't know why, but it seemed to teach much easier than it used to be.
Really?
I think there's a few things they've changed. Like now, if you have a monster figure on the board, now you have to forfeit those priestesses in order to keep them on the board. So that's going to reduce that income. I think this is why I'm more disappointed. I really hope that all the problems were fixed, and they were not. It was just a disappointing game. Both of them were.
Yeah, it's longer, it's looser, and it can still end in any number of unsatisfying ways.
Because they even changed the bidding track, where it doesn't increase by one. It goes like 1, 3, 5, 7, and just ramps up.
So that is Cyclades Legendary Edition, designed by Bruno Cathala and Ludovic Montblanc, and published by Open Sesame Games.
And now, a brief break to pay some bills.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
And we're back with more games. Played another game of Whale Riders. It was by Reiner Knizia, published by Grail Games. He may or may not have been paid for designing Whale Riders for Grail Games. We don't know. But I love Whale Riders. It is one of my favorite family weight strategy Euro games. And it is all about taking a risk on the available markets. It's about timing. It's about seeking out new markets, about knowing when to push your luck, to go to that area and spend that movement and go ahead of the pack to try to get first access to those lovely tuna steaks.
To drive the pace,
or whether it makes sense to hang back. And this is exactly what happened here. Louis just stayed at a market after we had all left, and we were all cannibalizing off of each other, racing against storms, trying to get those goods, and he just sat there, perfectly happy to be left behind and just steadily put in the work. Very much like Louis himself. It was very characteristic. And he ran away with the game as a consequence. Just because he had the courage and the foresight to stick around when we were all felt the sort of self-imposed pressure to move on to the next market. And Whale Riders, sometimes that's the right call. Sometimes being left behind will absolutely burn you. But in this case, it worked out very much to his advantage. And being able to read the board and read the other players and know when to do that, that's one of the central tensions in Whale Riders. And I think that it is a testament to the overall quality of the rule system that you can have these tempo considerations in such a simple, simple economic model. It was a joy to get back to Whale Riders. Big fan of it. And it is always on my mind when I have to think of a relatively quick, very, very approachable rule set. Reiner Knizia, Grail Games, 2021, Whale Riders.
Last episode, we talked about Figment. This is one of the new Magenta games put out by CMYK. And I was telling Mark, so if you have a partner that doesn't really play games, you know, they once in a while play a game, but if you enter the room and they already have a game set up for you and are waiting for you and said, what is taking so long? Why aren't you in here playing a game? This is a testament to how good this game is, you see. So in Figment, that has... The artist is SMLXL. Now, I sort of looked this up, and I think this is a sort of a publishing company. So I'm not sure. I typed it in, and one of these publishing companies came up. And so maybe it was them, maybe it was something else. And so it has 5 different colors in different percentages on the card, and you have to assess what these percentages are because you flip up a color, and then you have to put them in ascending order of what has the bigger percentage of that color on the card. And these cards are fantastic looking, very sort of nouveau, arty, weird conglomerations of these colors. And it leads to lots of talking and speculation and back and forth, and overall is just a well put together game.
And weird heuristics.
Yes.
Where you're trying to evaluate the total surface area of circles versus these weird jagged lines versus these weird waves versus these weird tessellated. It's so strange and challenging.
And what colors are covering up other colors and how much white there is on the card.
Okay, could you explain that? I confess I didn't fully internalize your rubric of how much white there is.
Because
on the card.
Sometimes you can get carried away because there could be this huge like pink blob on the card,
okay,
say. And all the other colors aren't very, you know,
prevalent
on the card. So you might say, you know, well, that's at least 80% of the colors on that card are pink.
I see.
But you're not paying attention to this white giant white border that's around the outside of
you
the card.
You can be blinded by the overall proportion of pink with respect to the other colors,
yes.
Not paying attention to what you need to be paying attention to, which is the proportion of pink on the overall surface area of the card.
Just so.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Yes. That is one of the ways. I'm really garbage at Figment. I can't really. And some rounds are really rougher than others. I remember one round we did where the cards were something like 12% to 14% to 16% to 17%, and we had to get those in a run. If it's more like 8 to 15 to 20 to 35, that's no problem. It's usually much easier to visually identify those.
And then they have this very sort of interesting bidding system, too, where you have these tokens that are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And those, you also have 5 rounds in the game, and so you know you're going to have to use one of those tokens every round. And so you have to sort of judge. It's like, well, every round's going to be close, but this round we're definitely sure we've got this in the right order. So we're going to use the 5 this round. That's going to add to your score. And then on top of that, you get to choose which end of the sort of ascending cards you're going to start from. Because if you're really sure about the start and you're not sure about those last two cards, then you can start at the low end. Or if you know near the end you got it right, then you start with the high cards and work your way down. Lots of solid things happening in Figment.
So it's just a plain score attack system, which is not my preferred version, but as you say, the choice of the tokens and the ability to decide to start from one end versus the other does give you a surprising amount of control and decision. What is your best result so far? I have yet to crack bronze.
Like I said, Butterfly and I have gone into the advanced game.
Oh.
So we go up to 6 cards. And you have to get them all in order, and we have cracked into bronze in that. So we hit gold a bunch of times in the normal game.
Okay.
So we said that, well, why don't we just go up to this new part? And so now we're playing in the advanced part.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know that I was in the presence of an expert.
I am going a lot on this Figment. So I don't want people to think that it is this heavy, you know, elaborate game. It is, when we played it at our event this week, it was because, you know, I would like to play something in 5 minutes that I can teach in 5 minutes, and that's all it is. Very quick,
yeah,
very
you,
simple.
You flip a card and you say, does this have more green or less green than this other one?
Yeah.
There you go. That's
it's not. It's,
and yet.
And yet, it is. There's a lot there for, because it was, you know, a friend of ours came in that we don't see very often. It's like, well, I was on my way out, but I want to play a game. We got it out, taught, you know, there was 5 of us, so I taught, you know, three new players how to play. They all seemed to enjoy it. Figment.
So I got my Kickstarter order in of the new Kabuto Sumo stuff. Kabuto Sumo is the insect theme sumo wrestling game where you are shoving wooden discs onto a platform trying to knock your opponent off that pedestal and or to try to outlast them. And the new expandalone is called Kabuto Sumo Sakura Slam. It introduces a whole bunch of new wrestlers. It introduces a new mode, or at least standard set of rules for the two-player game, which can help alleviate complaints that some people have occasionally encountered where there can be a bit of a stalemate, where you're constantly just shoving back and forth, no one making any progress. I have not encountered this difficulty, frankly, very often, maybe once in the dozen or so games that I've played. But even then, the game did go to a conclusion. It just outstayed its welcome. But some people have had very, very bad experiences with stalemates. And now there are new rules that help alleviate that, so that's for the best. And there's also a new ring. There's a square ring, which is both good and bad. It gives more dynamism and less dynamism. It is less dynamic in that instead of being able to approach from anywhere around a circular ring, you now must approach from one of the four corners. And so that necessarily means you can't go from the middle and you're kind of stuck at specific entry points, strictly speaking 8, because you can approach any corner from 2 sides. It is more dynamic, though, in that a number of the powers and even the base rules encourage you to go to all four corners as much and as often as possible, because you can cash in tokens that you put on the corners, which you get every time you push from that corner, to do various things. And so it will not lead to a sort of I always push from the same angle situation, which some people have encountered in Kabuto Sumo. I adore Kabuto Sumo. I've always been tickled by the theme. I've always been tickled by the execution. I love the special powers. So many bugs come with their own custom wooden pieces that are sometimes jokey references to professional wrestling, sometimes are references to sumo wrestling, and sometimes are just random references, like there's a reference to Teddy Roosevelt. Why not?
Why not?
It's Kabuto Sumo. Anything goes. And I have, I don't have everything in the Kabuto Sumo line. This is, every Kickstarter gives you an opportunity to reflect on the various promos and elements that you don't have, and therefore represent a hole in your heart. But I've abandoned my completionist impulses. And so I was very pleased with myself to notice, oh, I don't have the following insects for Kabuto Sumo. That's fine. I have lots of Kabuto Sumo. I also got my little Beetle Rikishi plushie, which is very adorable. And I've got the upgraded wooden rings, which I haven't had a chance to use yet because I only played with the cardboard ring of Kabuto Sumo Sakura Slam. It was, as I said, it was both more dynamic and less dynamic all at the same time. And I mostly just appreciated being able to experiment with new powers. One of the bugs actually has a custom piece that fits on top of the, well, the turnbuckle, effectively, the corner post. And when they cash in their power, when they activate it, they just get to spin it around 360 degrees around that corner. And anything that gets knocked off, they get to keep. And so that basically locks down a corner of the board where the opponent doesn't want there to be much action because they might be able to pocket everything that's going on there. Anyway, I'm a big fan of Kabuto Sumo. It's a small and delightful game. You can get now one of two expandalones, either the base game Kabuto Sumo or Sakura Slam. And I think that the components are extraordinarily well done. And it is just a joy to play, whether or not you are motivated by the theme of some various references to wrestling in general. So, Kabuto Sumo Sakura Slam, designed by John Brigger, Michael Dunsmore, and Tony Miller, fulfilled near the end of 2014 by All Play, pursuant to successful crowdfunding, Kabuto Sumo.
Portmanteau is a cooperative game of linguist fusion designed by Robert Fisk. Now, you'd think Robert Fisk, that's a very board game designing name. Not so much. He hasn't designed many games. This is put out by Dog Hala Games,
which itself is kind of a portmanteau.
It's true. And so what a portmanteau is, you take two words and you fuse them together into one word. That makes no sense.
So like smog, which is smoke and fog, or spork, which is spoon and fork.
So what you're doing is you get...
Or all those celebrity smush names, for example. Some of those are pretty funny.
It's true.
Yeah.
So you get a bunch of sort of Dixit-type images, or more like...
More like code names.
More like code name pictures that are definitely going to be a one-word thing. And then you get a little bit of...
Try to make them a one-word
thing. And then you put them into a grid. And then you have a sort of a grid deck where you draw two of them. And it'll tell you which two of those words that you have to fuse together. And they give you a little bit of, you know, play on... You get to sort of say what that image is. You know, it's fairly standard. But you can... You know, you have a little bit of play.
Well,
but you don't want to use too much play.
Your job is to be understood. So there's no reason to go wildly afield of what the picture is.
And then you need to take the back of one of those words and the front of the other word and mash them together and then say your word.
And then it is the job of everyone else to infer which two pictures you were told to make a portmanteau out of.
And then the other difficult part of the game is that you need to, there are a bunch of numbers at the top. You need to get through all those numbers. It goes from 3
to 8.
And you have to form words as you go around the table. Everyone gets turns that have those many letters in it. So the 3 and the 4, very difficult. Even up to 8 sometimes can be difficult as well.
Oh, I don't know. I find 7 and 8 really easy. Those three-letter portmanteau, that's one letter from one word and the last, either the first two or the last two of another word. I find it so difficult. You did a great job of it, the game you played, but I find it so conceptually difficult to find a way to identify one of the 9 pictures with a single letter that won't cause confusion.
It's true. I love wordplay games. I love this game. Looking forward to playing it some more. What else do you have to say about it, Mark?
Portmanteau is really well done. It's reasonably quick, and it encourages you to try to think a little bit laterally. You don't have full latitude in terms of what you're going to pick in terms of the pictures that you're trying to indicate, but you have a certain degree of latitude in terms of what you specifically call them. Some of the pictures aren't particularly transparent, and a certain amount of latitude in terms of how long or short the portmanteau is going to be. Now, near the end of the game, your options diminish, and so you end up being forced. But I find that level of creativity is just enough, and I really appreciate that level of ingenuity on the part of other people. I'm not good at the game, so I'm not really in a position to portmanteau to talk about any past successes. I've mostly had misplays. This is a review copy we got from the designer. I will say, though, that a lot of the pictures are strangely, like, managerial or org charty. There's a lot of stuff that you might think is, like, a clip art on your PowerPoint deck. And it's just a very high proportion of that. And that's weird and not especially satisfying, I gotta say. Other than that, the pictures, for the most part, are good. Very much in the vein of probably this one thing or could be one of a couple of things, which, again, is a good level of ambiguity. But the number of things that just look like an org chart are utter madness. I do not understand where they come from, and I don't understand why there's this high a proportion of it. And I don't think it serves the game very well.
And sometimes it comes down to a lot of just straight-out guessing. Like, random. It's like, okay, well, these last three things will end in orc. So we'll pick this one because he might have picked that one.
A lot of co-op games can descend into guessing, and that's fine. Portmanteau, a cooperative game of linguistic fusion by Robert Fisk and Doug Holla Games. That's where especially noble canine warriors
just
go
so.
After they die. Finally, I played a game called Dragon Valley. This is a game from 2012 that I played shortly after its release and is now up on crowdfunding again after more than 10 years. There's a new expansion on Kickstarter. More on that later. We'll talk about it in the news segment. This was designed by C.W. Karstens and self-published under the label Diamond K Games. This is an I Split, You Choose game. You can play it from 2 to 4. I've played it at those player counts, at the player counts 3 and 4. I do not recommend it at 4, because then there's this weird, awkward, forced team element that gets shuffled back and forth. In a 3-player game, you divide everything up. You get a bevy of buildings and cards and units, some of them enemy, some of them friendly, in a random distribution every round. And you divide them up into 3 piles, and the other 2 players each pick their pile, and you end up with whatever's left. Now, fortunately, the splitting is not always taken care of by the same player, because, of course, it is disadvantageous to split. And ultimately, it is there's a sort of crude catch-up mechanism in that it is the people with fewer points that tend to get to pick first. What I really like about Dragon Valley is 2 things. Number one, I enjoy that you're drafting the enemies that you're facing. At the beginning of the game, it can seem daunting. It's like, oh, I don't want all these enemies. Later on in the game, you desperately want them because the machinery of death that you've developed in your particular lane is so good that they're just points to be had. And so managing that tipping point is interesting, and managing that that strange dynamic is really cool about how suddenly units, they're super valuable at the beginning of the game, but later on they become less valuable because you've got all the buildings in a row and you don't really care. It's fine. You just want more things to kill. The other thing that I really appreciate about Dragon Valley is that in the first Kickstarter campaign, there was this absurd gonzo promo called Dragon Valley Tourneys that speaks to my fundamental preferences as a human being. There's a bit of downtime in Dragon Valley because the person who's making the split, they don't really have much opportunity to further their own interests. All they can do is make mistakes. And so sometimes that leads to a fair bit of analysis paralysis as they're figuring, you know, it's over a dozen elements to split up in 3 lots. And they know that the stakes are high. So what Dragon Valley's Tourneys does is it introduces an absurd series of minigames based on dexterity and or rock, paper, scissors that the other players do while the splitter is splitting. And under certain conditions, if there's enough time and if they complete the minigame, they can score a real in-game point. And that just adds just enough pressure to make sure that the splitter gets their job done. It is ridiculous and I love it. And that element, I think, is what I love most about Dragon Valley. Dragon Valley Tourneys is not an especially good set of dexterity challenges. It's not a particularly satisfying set of rock, paper, scissors things. But it's great, and I adore it. The fundamental game itself, I think, has held up reasonably well. I suspect I may be somewhat alone in this. Rocker, what are your thoughts?
It definitely felt like a game that was 10 years old.
How
like,
so?
It just, the production and just like a lot of the stuff that was left behind, like you're drafting all of these buildings, and almost all of us had this giant stack of buildings off to the side that we just never used. And in today's design, that would never happen.
That is true.
You wouldn't have this stuff that you would just not use. And like Mark said, there's two paths that you can go down, and I would say that you need to do both. I unfortunately just went down one and therefore had not as a good time as other players. I should have diversified. Because there's so much randomness, you're going to get random units out of the bag paired up with random monsters coming out of the bag. So if you just go into making this intricate sort of, like Mark said, death machine where the monsters come in and they get pushed off the cliff, then you're relying on the right monsters and or monsters at all coming out of the bag. Whereas if you rely on units going out into the field and conquering these faraway places, then again, you're now hoping that units come out of the bag, and only that you get them, or they're put in the lots that you can get, or the right units that you need come out. Anyway, lots of randomness.
I mean, I feel that that's mitigated enough by the fact that there's this draft and the I split you choose elements. It's not the case that at the top of the round, everyone gets four cubes from the bag and that's that. You can look over and see, oh, Mark scored 12 points by turning all the dragons into lemmings last round. I should try to make sure that any lot with dragons includes a poison pill that's either bad for Mark or even it's just by itself. So if Mark takes it, that's all he's going to get. And so I think that there's a certain amount of control one can exert in these contexts.
There is. No, I'm saying you can control what people pick, but whether monsters come out at all or the monsters that you need come out. Like, maybe dragons won't come out at all.
It's true.
And you get no dragons. But anyway, I would play it again. And like I said, I would diversify and therefore, you know, rely less on the right units and the right cards coming into my lots that I might bid on.
Yeah, Dragon Valley, I don't think is... has the makings of a perennial classic. It's not the kind of thing that I'm going to be recommending all the time. But I do think it does a couple of interesting things in the I split you choose element. Although I agree with you that some of the finer details, whether it's the way resources enter the system at a broad macro level, or if it's the way that so many of the buildings end up unused, does indicate that there are some rough edges that ideally could be ironed out. I mean, I'm going to take a look at what the expansion adds, but as it is, Dragon Valley is the kind of thing that I've played, you know, three times over the course of the past 10 years, and that seems like a pretty good rate.
And then there's the cards. I'll just go quickly on the cards. There's also a deck. I don't even want to call it a deck of cards. There are a few cards. You know, in our game, there was five. So there would be five cards that were dealt out every round that get added into the lots. And of this deck of cards, there are three that are useful. The rest are are situational and borderline useless.
Well, no, but because they're situational, that is further grist for the allocation and distribution. Let's focus on the revolt card, right? Either you have a prison or you don't. You've either drafted and built a prison, which are situational elements, in which case the revolt card gives you the possibility of scoring points. Or in my case, it didn't. I didn't cash in at the right time, so I didn't actually manage to score it. This is largely because people hate drafting it away from me because they are mean. If you don't have a prison, this card is a must. This card is a must play, and you will lose a point as a consequence. This again, like, it's not. Look, I'm not going to say it's like Raw, but like how lots can mean different things to different people, this is the grist for the drafting.
True. As me, I wish the deck was more robust.
I think at the very least, it would have been nice to not have to shuffle the deck so often. But yes, that is fair. And that is Dragon Valley by C.W. Karstens, published originally in 2012, currently on Kickstarter. Those are the games we played last week. And now onto the news and why it doesn't matter. On that topic, Dragon Valley is up on Kickstarter. There's a new expansion called Advisors and Quests. If you're at all curious for a middleweight I split you choose game, so there's a, you know, New York Slice and the pie game with cream. It's about pie, so it's not very good because pie is not a particularly satisfying confection, despite what the pie lobby would have you believe, which I think is just a front for the mathematics nerds. But anyway, setting all of that aside, I do think that it does some interesting stuff, and it is worth taking a look at Dragon Valley.
There's going to be a one versus many board game based on 2001 A Space Odyssey. The production looks atrocious. The conceit seems interesting.
Is the one HAL?
Yes.
Okay. Do you know what occurred to me the other day when going through and reorganizing my board game collection? Prospero Hall really hasn't been doing much lately. There was a solid few years where they were releasing a lot of enjoyable licensed stuff, but Prospero Hall is not really much of a thing. Maybe Funko has decided not to be as much into board games, for one. Because I could totally imagine Prospero Hall doing a 2001 Space Odyssey game.
No, it's a video game company that's doing it. Someone sure. That's doing something. It's totally out of left field.
Paolo Mori and Alessandro Zucchini are going to be publishing an entry-level historical war game called Battlefields of the Napoleonic Wars. I love me the Napoleonic Wars. Well, rather, I find it an interesting period of history. I'm not in favor of bayoneting people to death. Contrary, don't let the rumors on Reddit lead you to believe otherwise.
Like, not in the back, right? Just frontal bayoneting.
I mean, there's an art to it. If you take it seriously, have some respect for the craft.
Yeah.
We are big fans of the games of Paolo Mori here on So Very Wrong About Games. They're going to be starting their own company, Ingenioso Hidalgo, to publish Battlefields of the Napoleonic Wars. It is slated to come out later this year.
Lastly from me, there is a game that the art is fantastic. It's called Freya's Swamp. This will be a game from the same people that gave us Terra Mystica and Gaia Project. So, you know, the pedigree's there. It looks a little interesting. You're moving out and exploring the swamp. You're drafting these sort of guide cards that are going to give you like an ability and sort of the turn order. And I haven't read that much into it, but just the art alone looks fabulous. So more to come, I'm sure, about Freya's Swamp.
It's Freya's Swamp.
Freya's Swamp. Yeah, there's no R there, Mark.
There's no R, Walker.
Don't pronounce the R when it's not there.
I was thinking this was going to be some sort of weird Norse mythology thing. I didn't know Freya had a swamp, but there you go. Can't imagine Freya in a swamp. Doesn't seem to jive.
It's not her gig.
Yeah, so
she doesn't do swamps.
Freya's Swamp, designed by Helga Ostertag and Anselm Ostertag. So that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. We sincerely and genuinely appreciate that you decided to spend some time with us. It means the world to us. Thank you for your support. Thank you for your time. We hope to see you again soon. Take care of yourselves. Take care of your hobby.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.